Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can unlock ad-free versions of the podcast for $3 a month and get bonus episodes on current TV, movies we don't cover on the podcast, and other topics for $5 a month. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast that's usually devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release, but not this week. I'm Tasha Robinson, here with
Scott Tobias
and Keith Phipps.
Normally, this is the spot where we'd offer a mild movie-related joke about where our missing co-host is, but in this case, we're recording on a Monday night just ahead of the holidays, and Genevieve is hard at work editing the episode of the podcast that releases tomorrow on Tuesday, so we're going to leave her to it while we break format for our end-of-the-year episode. As usual, we're capping 2023 with an episode where we talk about the movies we loved this year. How did 2023 treat you all in terms of movies? Do you think this was a good year for movies? And do you have any strong takeaways on the world of cinema?
Well, I always like to quote our friend, the Vulture critic, Bill Gabieri, who says that every year is a good year for movies. And I think that's true, except for me, it was an extremely backloaded year for movies. So many of the films in my top 10, in fact, all of my films in the top five that we'll be discussing on the show, I did not see until the fall. So that little preview there, if distributors want to spread things out a little bit, I think I'd appreciate that. I'm looking at January and laughing at how insanely ridiculous it looks. If they want to throw a good movie in there, I'd like that. But
Hey, Haunted Swimming Pool, Scott. Haunted Swimming Pool.
A Haunted Swimming Pool. That's the one I'm looking forward to the most.
I know.
What about you all?
Is it called Death Pool, the pool that eats?
No, it is not. That's a good name for it, though.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
I'm just going to repeat what I think I've probably done this word for word last year, if not the year before. But like, I always worry about movies. And at the end of the year, when I'm putting together these lists, like, oh, wait, this is a really good year for movies. There's a lot of good movies out there. A lot of them are backloaded, as Scott mentioned. But like, I have a top 30 list here that easily, you know, you can sub in some of these lower ones on the upper one. You know, this is where I am today. I could be somewhere else tomorrow with these films. So, yeah, I mean, it's as far as the state of movies in general, maybe, you know, I'm going to echo Scott. It does kind of make it feel like it's not a great year until you get to the end of it. Although there are quite a few earlier year films in my top 10 list. That's foreshadowing. Tasha, how about you? Was it a good year for you?
It was a good year, but I mean, it's pretty typical for me to end up with a top 10 of the year list that really heavily reflects movies that came out in November, December. That's pretty average. But this year, I didn't really feel a gap leading up to the end of the year. There was a lot of interesting stuff that came out earlier in the year. My problem was a sense that I saw too many just really slot-filling, mediocre, entirely okay movies in the lead-up. You know, part of my job is watching a lot of streaming movies and trying to at least keep up to some degree on what the streaming services are putting out. And, you know, for every Netflix is going to throw a bunch of money at David Fincher, or Apple TV Plus is going to throw a bunch of money at Martin Scorsese out there. God, there's just so much. We figure that you're going to watch this on the couch, kind of semi-paying attention, fiddling with your phone kind of stuff. That might be fun in the moment, but, you know, is it going to last?
I think that sentiment reflects someone who has a heart of stone.
I saw that one. Woof. It's so weird. That's a whole other discussion, but there is, when the streamers spend a ton of money on a blockbuster, it really feels like, they all feel like the most expensive made straight-to-video films you've ever seen. The Heart of Stone is a perfect example of just like, this is just kind of like a fake blockbuster. This is like something you couldn't get people to pay for in a theater, but, you know, they feel like they're getting some value out of their Netflix subscription because it looks so expensive.
It's almost as if they were made by somebody shooting for, you know, in the middle, mediocrity, some kind of gray man, perhaps.
All right. Well, both of you are on red notice. We're going to get on to the movies that we really snap. Like. as opposed to dissing the movies that we didn't like. Although it is sort of tempting. Every year, I kind of miss, like, in the AV Club days, at least, we tried so hard to have somebody see every movie of the year that we were able to put together a worst of the year list at the end of the year that felt fairly inclusive. And these days, in the streaming days, there's no way we could really identify what scraped the bottom of the barrel. And I don't know about you, but I just don't see many of those movies anymore. And part of that is also being a senior editor who assigns other people to see the worst stuff out there. But I do wonder what our worst of the year episode would look and feel like. And I bet it would be a very jolly conversation, even if it was not, you know, the most optimistic about how much movies are great and we love movies.
I mean, worst of lists have gotten controversial, and, like, you know, there's a couple of threads, and, like, I kind of get it, like, you know, they were just kind of overwhelmingly everywhere, but also, like, I don't think they're as fun anymore, because for the reasons we were just talking about, it's like, there are fewer just outright awful movies, and just a lot of really boring ones. They're, like, competent, but, you know, just that.
You know, it's, now that I think about it, it's really been years since I paid any kind of attention to the Razzies. I should probably look in at those.
Don't. They're horrible.
Well, but that's just it. They're horrible and they're hated. And therefore, I kind of ignore them. But it might be illustrative to see, like, who they're taking pot shots at and how that's contributed to the feeling that worst of lists are kind of, you know, déclassé and childish. But regardless, this week we don't have any pairing of movies, we don't have any shared theme, we don't have any of the usual feedback or recommendation segments. We're just going to jump in and talk about our favorite films of 2023 in a round-robin top 10 that covers what we most enjoyed this year. So stay with us, and we'll be back to get started right after this break. All right, guys, we're going to jump into this fairly informally. As usual, we could do a full rundown of our top 10, top 20. I'm with Keith. I've got a top 30 because my process for these things is make a huge list of what I saw, eliminate the things I didn't like, try to order everything else. And then, you know, I end up with like 30 movies that I'm fiddling around with. So we could make this like 6 hours long, but we're not gonna. And it's less for y'all's sakes and less for Genevieve's sake as editor, I think, and more for our listeners who just really don't have time in their lives right now to deal with a 6-hour rundown on every film we saw this year and how we felt about it. So let's do what we always do. And Keith, we'll start with you. You're going to blitz through your bottom 5 on your top 10. What's 6 through 10 look like on your list?
6 through 10, the worst of the best. my bottom 10 are an old favorite. From an old favorite director, we got Asteroid City at number 10, which I think is a film that's only going to improve through... I've seen it twice. I liked it better the second time. I think it's only going to improve through repeat viewings. My number 9 is a debut film from Raven Jackson called All Dirt Roads Taste of Salt, which is a very lyrical, chronological look at events in the life of a black woman, and woman growing up in Mississippi in some sort of indeterminate time, which I've seen in a theater. It really is quite cinematic in some really, really compelling ways. All of Us Strangers is my number, 8? My number 8 film is Andrew High's latest drama. It's sort of a fantasy drama about a writer who reunites with his parents, except it's not quite that. It's really quite good. It will jerk at your heartstrings. So fair warning. Number 7, The Boy and the Heron, which we just talked about at length, the new Miyazaki movie, which I think is a, you know, strange and thorny and beautiful possible last film. If not, it feels like a kind of a final statement. And at number 6, I got Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, a very winning adaptation of Judy Blume's classic novel. It stuck with me all year for a bunch of different reasons. It is delightful and deep and quite, you know, quite memorable. I wish more people had seen it, but it's out there. Go watch it. Hey, that's just my opinion, though. Scott, what about you?
Well, I have to join you. There are a couple of films I need to put an asterisk around. One is Asteroid City. The other one is the David Fincher film, The Killer, that just feel like movies that are kind of growing in my head that I've seen once. And it's like, you know what? I bet you those films are better than they went down. They went down really well, but it's like, man, maybe I see them again and I'm going to be regretting my list. And there's a lot of films I could mention that would be on honorable mentions, films that I have yet to see that I should say as a caveat when we do our list for the reveal will, you know, which comes in a couple of weeks, I'll have seen more films. So things may shift around. But here's what I got. End of disclaimer. My number 10 is Poor Things, the Yorgos Lanthimos film. Incredibly funny. A hoot. Something that is one of those films that our discussion here on The Next Picture Show really sort of enhanced my appreciation for what Lanthimos was doing. So that's at number 10. Number 9 is Return to Seoul, which is one of those annoying films that kind of is a 2002 film, but wasn't really released in 2002. And I'm saying no to all of that. And just including it on my list, it's a really striking independent film about a young woman of Korean heritage who goes to Seoul and has herself quite an adventure. My number 8 film is Showing Up, the Kelly Reichardt film, which to me is such a strong statement of purpose, a very personal and very beautifully proportioned film. My number 7 film is Oppenheimer, which I think we're all familiar with. That's the Christopher Nolan film, a film of incredible vision and weight and excitement. My number 6 film is Our Body, which is a 3-hour French documentary that explores in a Frederick Wiseman-ish way the gynecological wing at a hospital. And it gives you sort of a broad range of experiences, and it has kind of an interesting personal edge as well. So those are my 10 through 6. What about you, Tasha?
Well, you're going to hear a few of these titles again. Number 10 on my list is Christopher Borgli's Dream Scenario, the Nicolas Cage movie where he plays a very boring professor who starts showing up in everybody's dreams. You know me, I love weird, messy films that are trying to say a whole lot and go in a lot of different directions and that surprise me both with their premises and how they play out. I think this is a messy movie in some ways, but just like a really fun, creative, and distinguished look at, you know, kind of the penalties and benefits of fame, particularly viral fame. My number 9 is The Origin of Evil, Sebastian Marnier's kind of neo-noirish family drama slash, well, it's almost a heist movie. It's definitely a crime movie. I could tell you more specifically what the genre is, but that would be giving things away because this is just an exceedingly dark and nasty and in very interesting ways. Story about people who are using each other. Let's just say that. A really, really great little nasty French crime drama. Number 8 is Hirokazu Koreeda's Broker, a film that for a lot of the rest of the world came out last year, but we got it this year. This is a 2 Hirokazu Koreeda film year for America, because we also just recently got his new movie Monster. Of the two of them, I felt like Broker is just like a more complete movie. It's a kind of complicated character piece. Of course, it's a Koreeda movie, so it has to do with children and parents and ersatz families and relationships and people changing like very rapidly over time. But fundamentally, at the start of it, it's about people who sell babies and, you know, how that goes wrong, as one might inevitably think that it would. It's more of a comedy, I think, than Monster, and it's sweeter in a lot of ways, and I really enjoyed it. Number 7 and number 6 in that order are Barbie and Oppenheimer. Almost have to see them in proximity with each other, and I dithered a little bit about what order to put these in because I had more fun at Barbie, but Oppenheimer think is yeah, you know, I know, hard to understand.
Wait a minute.
But Oppenheimer, here's the thing, though. I think these are both very principled, very thoughtful, very well-planned and written movies where the execution is part of the process of getting the story that the filmmaker wants you to take on board kind of past your guard. I think they're actually both doing something very similar in a way. They're just doing it in remarkably different ways. But Barbie hit me much, much harder at the time in the theater, and Oppenheimer has stuck with me much longer in terms of individual sequences, individual choices, and just how the whole thing lands. So I'm putting them in that order. I really enjoyed them both, but Oppenheimer for the win on this one. And that's my bottom five of the top 10, which is a weird way to put it, which means it's time.
It's very weird.
Any sort of comments on everyone's top or your bottom five or your top 10? I was really happy to see Dream Scenario on yours, Tasha. I like that movie too. It's sort of unwieldy and kind of it goes wherever it wants to at any point. But yeah, and thanks for the reminder on Corrieta. I need to catch. I'm always behind. I like him a lot. And besides those two films, he also has a miniseries on Netflix called The Mock and I, Cooking for the Maiko House. It's supposed to be really good too. So I don't know.
Broker's a good one. I was glad to hear it brought up.
He's just up there with the Dardenne brothers for me in terms of, like, there are a lot of things that I haven't gotten to yet. I'm in the same boat of still trying to wedge a few more films in by the end of the year. My letterbox to top 10 may end up being my final word on the year because, you know, I had to do an early top 10 list for Polygon, and I'm, you know, still adding and tooling stuff. Speaking of stuff that I came to late, Kelly Rickert's Showing Up, I only made time for pretty recently. And while that wasn't a top tenner for me, that movie really worked its way in under my skin. It's such a tricky film, Scott. Kelly Rickert kind of has a way of presenting you with these just like very low-key human scenarios where you just kind of observe people having conversations and doing stuff. And you kind of think, it doesn't feel especially pointed. It's just a bunch of stuff that happened. And then suddenly you get towards the end and you see what the point is, and it hits you like a stack of bricks. The impact of the end of this movie on me was pretty profound.
Yeah, and it was so meaningful to me, the Kelly Rickert film, just as a statement of principle. It's like, okay, this is a personal film. This is a reflection of the life that she's chosen to lead as somebody who is only makes independent films, who is an instructor at a small school, that is her job, who could have had other opportunities potentially if she had that ambition. She doesn't. And there's just such a nobility to that. And it's just so rare and singular, this career that she's carved out for herself and the way she kind of expresses it in such detail in the story. It's a hell of a movie and feels so key to her understanding her whole deal, basically. I guess the other thing that I would mention based on the bottom five of your top 10, Tasha, is that weekend, that Barbenheimer phenomenon, that was the greatest week of the year. I mean, like, how terrific was it that we had two Hollywood films that were really substantive and original and exciting, and it was the weekend that everybody went to the movies. Like, everybody wanted to see both of those films. Both of those films made a killing. That should be ringing in studio heads' ears about what people are really craving from movies. And so it was very hopeful, in addition to just being a great deal of fun. It felt like a very historic moment in 21st century cinema. So that's what I have to say about that.
It did feel like a historic moment, but for me, the takeaway was, once again, you kind of can't predict viral fame. I mean, you said this is what people want from movies in 2023, but what people wanted from that experience, like what started it all, was an in-joke, like a weird counterculture offbeat in-joke on the internet. And then it turned into like a participatory cultural thing. You know, it became, you're going to this event at the movies almost less to see these movies and more to show up like in costume and be part of a scene and participate in an in-joke. And then people realized the movies were awesome.
I think that's kind of a small percentage of the people, though. I mean, I don't think it can be a little, you can kind of be thrown off by people on Twitter representing the rest of the world, you know? I think people did want to see these movies. I don't think it was just necessarily that was drawing them in. Well, it certainly didn't, the Barbenheimer t-shirt certainly didn't hurt, you know?
Well, also the program to double features. I mean, I know that it is easy to over expect Twitter to represent the world, but, you know, the tickets that were sold for specifically this double feature were substantial and just kind of an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, that's true. I think AMC put out something, the ridiculous number of pre-sales for double features on this.
And, you know, studios have already tried to immediately pick it up and create new fake Barbenheimers. Hey, these two movies are coming out the same weekend.
What was like, there was like Saw Patrol, yep. Right? When Paw Patrol and Saw X came out. I don't know if that quite had the zeitgeist, but you try.
Somehow didn't land. And I think the only reason it didn't land in the same way was people weren't sure how to dress up for Paw Patrol. But yeah, Keith, as somebody who we're sure knows how exactly how to dress up for Paw Patrol, let's jump back to you. What is your number five movie of the year?
I was sitting here being all quiet while you're talking about showing up, because my number five is showing up. but you both covered it all quite eloquently. So I don't know. I have too much to add other than, Michelle Williams and Reichardt together are such a remarkable pairing. But her performance in this, it's so kind of tightly wound, kind of wears this sort of sour expression. But when that changes, it's so significant. I mean, when she decides, I guess I gotta take care of this bird now, it comes to really care about the bird. I mean, it's such a nice little arc for that character. I'm a big fan of that movie. I also came to it late too, Tasha. I wish I'd seen it in the theater, but when I did, I was like, oh, yep, this is one of the best of the year for sure.
My number five is The Holdovers, the Alexander Payne movie, which is about as satisfying an experience as I had at the movies. It was this year. It was just like, it was a film that I feel like Alexander Payne was making as if he was, it's not only set in 1970, it feels like he was making a movie that mainstream audiences might have seen and enjoyed in 1970. It feels, it's a film that I can recommend to almost anyone. It's a film about, with Paul Giamatti, who collaborated with Payne on Sideways, returning as this very difficult ancient civilizations professor at a private boarding school who is stuck over Christmas, over the Christmas break, watching the few privileged kids under his watch who are not being picked up by their parents, one in particular that he develops a relationship with, and also this, the cook played by Divine Joy Randolph in a wonderful supporting performance, who has lost a son to the war in Vietnam. And it's a film of humor and heart, and it's very soul satisfying. Watching it in the theater, you just feel transported in a way back to, what it might have been like to see a Hal Ashby film of that period or a Michael Ritchie film of that period. So I had a wonderful time watching that. So that was my number five. What about you, Tasha?
I have absolutely nothing to say in response to that discussion of The Holdovers. And certainly we're not coming back to that movie at all anytime later in this podcast.
Okay. For the way you, right until you got to the end of that sentence, I was like, oh my God, she hated it. But let's hear your number five, Tasha.
My number five is Hayao Miyazaki's The Boy and the Heron, which we did, in fact, talk about in detail. So I don't need to waste a lot of time here. But I suppose what it comes down to is just, Spirited Away remains my favorite Miyazaki film. It's just so fascinating to me to see a movie that he builds on such similar bones while telling such a different story about such a different character with seemingly such a different intent. Whether this is going to be his last film or not, I find it so hard to imagine that he has another one in him, but nobody thought he had this one in him. And then it just turns out to be so vibrant, so forceful, so much a man in control of both his art and his message. There's so many things going on in this movie. It's so visually beautiful, as his projects tend to be. But also just so visibly the work of a crank that has kind of fundamental problems with humanity while also loving, the energy of the natural world, the energy of children, the determination of youth and life and hope. What an experience to get to see another Miyazaki movie again in 2023, to get to sit down with this huge, thick sandwich of a movie and just kind of parse through all its many layers. I really, really dug Boy and the Heron, y'all.
It was such a special experience for me, too, because I saw it at the Chicago Film Festival at Music Box, a full house with my daughter, who's 15, and such a Miyazaki freak that she's going to start a club at her school. For Miyazaki, so seeing that with her and early was quite a special experience. It's another film I kind of want to just like Last Asteroid City and The Killer, just like a big time auteur film that I really want to kind of wrestle with a bit more. So good choice.
I thought so too, but what's probably also a good choice is, Keith, your number four. Let's hear it.
I wanted to cheat and just do Barbenheimer as one film, and ultimately,
ooh, yeah, too much cheating.
I know, I'm not doing it. And Barbie ultimately is hovering at the bottom, hovering in my top 10. I see it one more. I've seen it twice. If I see it one more time, it'd probably end up in my top 10. It's very clever and very substantive at the same time. But I'm just going with Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer's really good. Oppenheimer is an intense experience, a complicated one. I don't know if there is a director like Nolan as skilled at like throwing these really structurally complex films at audiences in ways that kind of teaches you how to watch it at the same time. But, you know, once you're grooving along with Oppenheimer, it all fits together really well. And the way it fits together is, you know, it's kind of walking everyone up to a fairly devastating, unsettling conclusions about, you know, this particular scientific development, science in general, the double-edged sword of any sort of technological and scientific breakthrough, particularly one in the service of the military. Yeah, fantastic stuff. It's another one I'm looking forward to watching again, as with all of these, actually. I'll stop saying that.
And not just bitter about science, not just a warning about scientific progress, but I think about governments and institutions in general. Like, I don't think of this as like a dismissively cynical movie, but it certainly is a thoughtful and analytical one about the effects of putting great powers in the hands of small people, or, you know, really indie individual people.
Yeah, so my number four is Anatomy of a Fall. This is a film that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. It's a courtroom drama, for the most part, you know, about this marriage sort of instigated by the death of the husband, and a question over whether his death was accidental or whether his wife killed him. And so that is what is at stake. And the one witness, kind of, is their son, who has kind of a disability in terms of his sight. This is a film that of just immense complexity. It's an interesting, I mean, anytime, and this is the same thing that happened with Saint-Omer, just the French court system is just nuts. And so you get a lot of time in the French court system, it is just incredible drama. I don't know if I saw a film with as many great performances in it, particularly Sandra Hüller as the main character, the wife. And then this actor Milo Machado Greener, who is the son, is just, he has this moment in court that's just like, you just don't get those kind of performances out of child actors. How did it happen? It could have been a movie called Scenes from a Marriage, or if they wanted to make it that way. So you really learn a lot about that relationship. It leaves you with a lot to think about. It's full of interesting ambiguities. And I thought it was a pretty darn good choice for the Palm. So I love that one. Anatomy of a Fall, my number four.
You know, that one didn't make it onto my top 10 in terms of the filmmaking itself. I think I tend to lean in end of the year towards, I guess, more like colorful, idiosyncratic choices, but it unquestionably has one of my favorite lead performances of the year. And it's unquestionably the movie that I've spent the most time talking about and thinking about after the fact. You know, it's,
yes,
ambiguities leave so much to discuss. And it's a really fascinating project in terms of throwing out a bunch of different possibilities and shaping a situation in a way that leaves you a lot to talk about.
Could have paired it with Rashomon if we wanted to, you know? Alas.
Easily. Yeah, I'll call it this weekend. But yeah, it's really strong. Not in my top 10, but maybe it should be. I don't know. It's really good.
Yeah, maybe it should be. Tasha, what about you? What's your four?
My number four is also a movie that we just discussed on the podcast. Yorgos Lanthimos' Poor Things. Again, messy movie, full of ideas and visual flourish and extreme oddities and just big, bold choices. Really enjoyed Emma Stone's performance here. She might be a most acting contender rather than a best acting contender, but I don't care. The story that's being told here about sort of a modern twist on Frankenstein, it's just really engaging to me, less so the mad scientist aspect and more so the analytical breakdown of like society from the point of view of an outsider. It's just a narrative arc that I tend to like a lot. The approach that the things that we take for granted don't need to be taken for granted, and we should like look at them all and question them from a completely naive point of view that doesn't assume anything, is just a really appealing artistic goal for me. And the fact that it can be done in such a hilarious way with so many other really intriguing, strange, exciting performances. Like, I tend to gravitate towards films that really try to push the boundaries of what mainstream cinema wants to do and how it can do it. And boy, this movie flipped all those triggers for me. So Lanthimos is Poor Things in my number four slot.
It's really good. I wasn't on that episode, so I had to weigh in real quickly and by saying it's really good. But I also think I'm not sure we. I think we're going to be sorting out just how good Emma Stone is in this movie for a long time. I mean, what a high wire performance, and what a journey she takes that character on. It's remarkable.
Just physically, I mean, just the physical evolution of just like of her kind of tracking. You know, her gait generally and being someone who is just has an adult body, but is sort of new to just, you know, the mechanics of being a human. It's so funny. It's such an incredible physical performance on top of just the wit. And she's incredible. She's having a hell of a year because she's something else on The Curse as well. So it's good stuff.
It was a good year for Emma Stone. We will come back to get everybody's top three of the year, but first we're going to take a little break. We're also going to watch Keith's cat continue to walk around on the back of his chair and send us emojis somehow. I'm not sure how that happened. We got a thumbs up off your keyboard there, Keith, from your cat.
Did you? I don't know how that happened either. Although I feel very thumbs up-y right now, so that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thumbs up podcast where we give the thumbs up to things, but your cat seems to be giving the biggest thumbs up to Poor Things. We will be back after this break to see if Keith's cat wishes to weigh in on any of the other films we're discussing in our top 10 of the year rundown. Well, we'll get back to our top five lists in just a moment, but first, we'd like to shout out Film Spotting, the Next Picture Show's mothership podcast, hosted by Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson. As we record this, Adam and Josh just released an episode with their top 30 performances of 2023, broken down into both supporting actor and lead actor lists. They're also gearing up for their year-end wrap party, which will take place this year in Los Angeles at Regal LA Live on Saturday, January 13. You can get tickets for that event at filmspotting.net. And while you're at it, you can take their latest poll. As we're recording this, the poll of the moment is for Movie of the Year. And I'm kind of delighted to say that the other category is currently in second place in that poll with a hefty 19% of the vote, which suggests a pretty wide ballot of things that people loved in 2023. Looking forward to hearing their Best of the Year episode as well and finding out what took the 2023 crown for their listeners. If you want to tell us what movie made 2023 for you, you can email us or call us. If you tell us not just what movie you loved most in 2023, but why, there's a good chance we'll feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Let's jump back into it. Keith, what is your number three movie of 2023?
My number three is May December, the latest film from Todd Haynes. As usual, typically slippery and complex film from a director who specializes in such things. It is from a screenplay by Sammy Birch and a story by Sammy Birch and Alex Mechanic, but it is inspired by the case of Mary Kay Letourneau and other such, you know, tabloid type figures, specifically that one, because that is a woman who seduced a much, much younger boy, but ultimately married him and had children with him. This film visits such a situation by way of an actress played by Natalie Portman, kind of going there to study it and spending time with both the wife, played by Julianne Moore, and her much younger husband, played by Charles Melton. And to me, it's kind of, there's a lot of it going on in this film, but I think in some ways it's about the unknowability of other people and the impossibility of rendering dramatically such a complex situation in any way that does justice to all the many weird shapes it takes. But yeah, I thought it was remarkable, really nicely done. Another film that's stayed with me long after I stopped watching it.
I really liked that one too. It, I think, also is maybe about just the stories that people tell each other and the struggle to live up to them. I think the device of having an actor come in and observe these people's lives and try to emulate them, or try to find whatever it is that she wants in order to emulate them in a way that she personally finds satisfying. I feel like it's a very clever kind of simultaneous skewering of like the art of filmmaking and film acting and the way that people kind of self-mythologize in ways that maybe are not often understood by the people around them or accepted by people around them. It's a naughty movie. It's another really good discussion artifact of 2023, I think.
You may hear it even further into the show.
Well, let's find out. Scott, what's your number three?
Well, that's not my number three, I'll tell you that. My number three is Killers of the Flower Moon, the Martin Scorsese film. It is another film, just immense in scope. I've seen it once. Maybe again, it might be a mover if I see it more than once. But what I think is striking about the film, which takes place in Oklahoma in the 20s, when the Osage territory turned out to be oil rich, and white people didn't like that and started killing them for their money. That's putting it, you know, it's more involved than that. But I think what's interesting about the movie, and this is, and I think this is something that is underappreciated about Scorsese's career, is that he really does, for a director who's so focused on individuals and, you know, internal crises, he's also a filmmaker who likes to tell stories about America as well and how it's built. If you think about films like Gangs of New York or Casino or Wolf of Wall Street or even Taxi Driver, this is the way Taxi Driver resolves itself, the ironies in that. He's kind of telling you a story here about who America belongs to and who it doesn't. You know, some hard truths about the way that the country works and how stories are even processed. I mean, this is a film where the end, the, you know, had my favorite ending of a movie this year, just because it had you rethink just about the way history gets told and reshaped. And it's just a fascinating film, beautifully performed, and it's just so rich on a story level and on a performance level and on a visual level. So yeah, Scorsese still killing it in his 80s. Killers of the Flower Moon is my number three. Tasha Robinson, what about you? What's your number three?
Well, strangely enough, my number three is, in fact, Killers of the Flower Moon. I've been at odds with a lot of the critical consensus about Martin Scorsese over the years. I think that he has a lot of obsessions and tastes that I just don't rhyme with particularly well. And as much as I enjoyed the lightness and the humor value and the speed of Goodfellas, a lot of his movies since then, I just haven't really appreciated the kind of like glee which with he engages with criminality. On the other hand, he can also, you know, be kind of lugubrious about it. And Killers of the Flower Moon for me is just the perfect balance. It's absolutely nothing like Goodfellas whatsoever, except in that it's about America and crime and, you know, people who tell themselves stories in order to make what they do to other people all right. But at the same time, like, even though it's just such a very different Scorsese, I love it in the same way. I was so engaged with this story. It's just so well told, so well paced, so well focused, built around such indelible characters and such a big representational story about America and the all of the bones that it's built on, you know, all of the sacrifices, usually unwilling, and oppression and occupation that it's built on. It's just mesmerizing as far as I'm concerned. In a year with a lot of very long movies, it was actually pretty rare that I noticed how long it was, how long any of these movies were after it got started. And this was no exception. I could have spent another couple of hours in this world. Killers of the Flower Moon, big recommend from me, the rarely agreeing with other people about Martin Scorsese person. Keith, what do you want to bring to the table for number two?
My number two is a film called Fallen Leaves, the latest from Finnish director Aki Kaurismäki, which is a very sweet, but I think quite meaty romance between two middle-aged people kind of on the fringes of the Finnish economy who find each other, but perhaps can't quite bring it together. It's short. It's short and sweet. It is sweet, but there is, you know, there's a lot of there's some darkness and some potential to go to some dark places here as well. It, at the end of its 81 minute running time, I was like, did I even see kind of a perfect movie? I mean, it's kind of a perfect movie. And it's like every piece is in place. These two performances, these two, you know, typically deadpan performances by Alma Poisti and Jussi Vatanen, you know, and very much in keeping with other Kaurismäki films. You know, it's a very perfectly calibrated for the sensibility of the film, which is, you know, quite, it's quite something, quite moving. And features, you know, all apologies to Anatomy of the Fall, features the year's best dog performance, a dog named Alma, who is playing a character whose name I shall not reveal because it's kind of a punchline. So if I think it may still be out in some theaters. If not, seek it out when you can. Fallen Leaves. Anyone else see this?
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I wrote about it for us, actually, yeah, right? Did. That was me. That was me, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was you.
Yeah, I'm a fan. I mean, I've been following Kaurismäki since I was just getting into movies. It was like, you know, I remember showing some of his films at the campus movie theater in the early 90s. In fact, Ariel, which is one of the movies that's part of the grouping, I guess it's a trilogy with four films at this point, I think, but it was the second film grouped with Fallen Leaves. So it's interesting to see certain themes repeat themselves. And then, of course, the first one is my favorite film of his period, called The Match Factory Girl, which is about as bleak a film as you could possibly handle. So it's nice to see, you know, Fallen Leaves gives you a little bit more warmth, I think, a little more light, and it's just so deftly handled by a filmmaker who's been doing it for decades now.
That one fell off my radar in the lead up rush to top 10 period. I've got a screener of it and definitely want to make time for it. It doesn't sound like it'll take a lot of time. I am aware that it's pretty short, but
exactly.
Boy, there have been a lot of films to fit in and a lot that I still haven't fit in. I will try to prioritize that one. Scott, what about you? What's your number two for the year?
My number two is May December, the Todd Haynes movie, which we've already discussed, but it is top drawer Haynes for me, because it is a film that is both extraordinarily layered, like a lot of his best works are. You know, he is someone who likes to make films of different textures and so, you know, films with a lot of density. But I think it's also a film of great emotional insight that is attempting and succeeding to do something very difficult in detailing what is really, you know, a relationship very similar to the one involving Mary Kay Letourneau. The thing I really love about this movie is by introducing this strange angle into it, by having this actress played by Natalie Portman come in and just do what actors do, which is to ask questions and to get to know people. It just opens up this Pandora's box. All of these questions that this couple had been setting aside for years bubble up again, and they have to really, you know, particularly the young man has to kind of reckon with things they hadn't really reckoned with before. This is a film of incredible depth and has another film with perfect ending. So yeah, May December, number two with a bullet for me.
I regret that kind of the quirk of timing on its release meant that we didn't get to do May, December, because boy, would I like to hear the unpacking of the ending of that movie from you. I've read a lot of different takes on it. I think it's a really, really interesting ending, and I suspect that it's one of those, what you come out of it, it may depend on what you bring into it things, but I really enjoy the end of that film.
It's not that kind of a snake. That's the line that's been going through my head. It's not that kind of a snake.
Well, another movie that does not have that kind of snake, or maybe a snake at all. My number two is The Holdovers. You were afraid that I hated this movie, Scott, but it was it was one of my favorite theatrical experiences of the year. The weird rollout of this movie and the fact that it opened in New York, I think a full month before it came to a Chicago theater that wasn't 15 miles out in the burbs meant I saw it, I think, with two other people in a theater. And I was just rapt. Another movie that's just kind of people talking and with like a slow roll effect. It's such a comedy at the beginning, and it never entirely stops being a comedy, but it kind of seduces you in with humor and then just builds this fortress around your heart. The places that that movie eventually goes, long past the point where I thought all of the reveals were done and all of the surprises were on the table, and that we knew these three people as well as we could possibly know film characters, they kept bringing out more about themselves, more reveals, more history, more ways of engaging with each other. And this thing just bypassed all my barriers against found family movies, too many of them. Irascible older man and a younger person who's kind of an orphan movies, and the two of them get together and bring out new things in each other. I've seen so many of them. I bristle a little heading into one. This movie just sidestepped all of my defenses. It's so well written and so well acted and such a pleasure in so many ways.
It's really good.
I saw it, actually was able to see it with an audience, and there was applause. This was, I think, maybe the one movie I saw at the end where people applauded. Obviously, other than, I mean, you know, you see a festival movie, there's applause there, but this was just a general, you know, it wasn't me and two other people. This was the Music Box with a decent crowd, but it just hit so hard, and it just made me imagine. I don't know if you had that experience too, Taj, of just thinking like movies can be this. This is a movie you can just recommend to everybody, and that a lot of people can get so much out of, and it's so satisfying.
Yeah, it's just a real, you know, roll with the discovery kind of movie. A movie where you probably think starting off that you know what it's going to be, and then it keeps shifting on you. It keeps kind of changing your mind as it changes its mind. The Holdovers, I absolutely loved it.
It's really good. It's really cool to see Divine Joy Randolph get a lot of acclaim for her work, kind of a breakthrough role for her. Giamatti is one of the best Giamatti performances. I was really struck by Dominic Sessa, too, who's the third part of that group. And I don't believe, it's his first film. And it's, you know, what a debut. He's really quite strong and not a weak part of that three-legged stool at all.
Yeah, Dominic Sessa is my breakout performance of the year. All three of them are essential. I've got a piece that's going to go up shortly on Polygon on best performances of the year. And instead of choosing one of them, I chose all three of them because, as you say, it's three legs of a stool. They're kind of inseparable from each other. But I love that Divine Joy Randolph's character isn't an accoutrement, you know, that we get to spend enough time with her to see that she's kind of got bigger things going on in her life than the other two. And even though she's like a Black woman in a story that's kind of centered around two privileged white men getting to know each other, there's a sense that she's not just there as a boost for their story or as an illustration of something. She's there to make it clear that she's got her own story going on in her own world in ways that they can't really access, she's got things going on that they can't really help her with. They're just too far outside her world. And I thought that was a very interesting thing for a movie in this genre to just openly acknowledge. But we've talked enough about my number two. Keith, your number one movie of 2023.
Oh, what's conspicuously absent so far from someone who enjoys the films of Martin Scorsese and his Killers of the Flower Moon? Just, you know, what to add? This is a huge, sprawling masterpiece of a film. As you both mentioned, you know, it has one particular story that it wants to tell, and it's a fascinating story, and one that is perhaps telling that I didn't know it. You know, I'd read the book before I saw this, but it's not a film that flatters the stories we like to tell ourselves, to use Tasha's phrase, about what America is. It is, it's remarkable stuff. Another film with three great lead performances from De Niro, DiCaprio, and Lily Gladstone. And another film, like May December, with a remarkable ending. I at one point thinking, you know, this is great. This is a fantastic movie. The only thing is, there's no way it's going to have an ending as memorable as The Irishman's. And then we got there. So yeah, my number one film of the year is Killers of the Flower Moon. Scott, how about you?
My number one movie is The Zone of Interest. This is the new film by Jonathan Glazer about the Holocaust, but in Auschwitz, except you spend not a minute inside Auschwitz, but just outside the walls of Auschwitz in a very nicely appointed home and garden where Rudolf Huss and the commandant of the camp and his wife are raising children and living their best life is, as you can hear, all sorts of extremely well designed horrible sounds in the background. It's so haunting. It's a film that's, you know, it's very unusual among Holocaust films. It's a film about the banality of evil, but also the, you know, the way people compartmentalize their actions through, you know, ideology. It is immensely disturbing, but extremely artful and disciplined, kind of Kubrickian. And it feels in a way like a companion piece to Under the Skin, and that it's just, and that these are two films about aliens who kill humans. Only one is capable of change, and it's not the it's not Rudolf Huss. You know, it's just, it feels to me that Glazer has gotten to this point where, you know, every new movie from him feels like an event, feels just you know, audacious, is just going for things that are so ambitious and exciting. This film I found quite riveting and disturbing, and I am weirdly wanting to see it again, as dark as it is. So The Zone of Interest is my favorite movie of 2023.
It certainly is getting a lot of attention and a lot of focus. I suspect that we're going to hear more from it when awards season rolls around.
Potentially. I mean, I think it's going to be a tough one, though. It's like it is... I ended up writing about Schindler's Lists, which had its 30th anniversary the same week. So I wrote about them both together, and they're a fascinating study in contrast. And one is definitely more accessible than the other. What about you, Tosh? I'm really intrigued now. What is your number one?
Well, I can guarantee you're not going to like it, Scott. This was a movie that I plumped for us doing on the show, and it came in a season of too many other movies, so we never got to fully throw down over Saltburn, my favorite movie of the year, and I hear a movie that you do not much care for. I will say this for it.
I don't want to, I'm not going to splash cold water on you, Tasha. Go, let's hear it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not doing it.
I'm... Shocked and appalled. I mean, what do people listen to this?
I have to say here that I am a conscientious objector in the Saltburn Wars because I have not seen it yet. So I'm just going to maybe just keep it that way.
I don't know. I mean, well, you know, you far more often fall on Scott's side of any debate or divide when it comes to movies. This movie is what I really wanted to pair it with on the podcast more than anything was Brimstone and Treacle, which is now a completely unavailable movie in which Sting rolls into a old English manor and seduces literally everybody, which is more or less what happens here, except instead of Sting, it's Barry Keoghan, who I think is just continues to emerge as one of cinema's most electric and interesting performers of the moment. Just he's becoming kind of the guy you go to when you need somebody who seems affable but has a hidden dark side, or maybe seems like he has a dark side and has an even darker side. This is essentially the story about a young social climber coming to Oxford and trying to get himself in with the smart set. And the more he sees about how the rich and casual and disdainful live, the more he wants it, the more he hungers for it, and the more he's willing to do to get his hands on it. It's kind of a fable. It's a very visually lush movie. It's got kind of big performances. It certainly has big salacious elements that are designed to kind of rivet and repulse people. And it's emerged as kind of one of the big divisive movies among critics in 2023 from the reviews I've read, primarily because of that aspect of it, because it's so consciously and pointedly subversive and transgressive. There are people who find that insulting, who think it's very childish and juvenile, like how far it goes. But I don't know. I mean, to me, the extremity of human behavior in this movie kind of parallels all of the things that Scott always says about Audition and the extremity of his precious beloved violence. This is a movie that's all about my precious beloved emotional violence. And It has a lot of things in it that I saw coming and did not see the way they were going to happen or the way they were going to be expressed coming. Listening to Emerald Fennell talk about this movie is just one of my favorite things in director interviews in 2023. I mean, I spoke to her, but there's a DGA interview that she gave online that's like an hour long that's just endlessly fascinating. So, Saltburn. Keith hasn't seen it. Scott is withholding his cold water, but I will
I'm not gonna
on a stack of Bibles and say I love this movie.
It goes hard. I will say it goes hard. I mean, like, you know, so it is a film that is I think, you know, geared almost to polarize in a way. I mean, in the sense, like, it is, it doesn't hold back. It makes very strong choices, and you fall on one side of the line or the other with the choices that it makes. So that's all I'll say. We fell certainly on opposite sides of the road. But I mean, I would watch, you know, 100 of those movies instead of what, you know, some mediocrity that I technically liked more. It's just, you know, this one just didn't really click with me, I will say. That's it. But I'm not going to do it. No cold water. Just to, you know, because again, I can see why it could be, it's a film that could be celebrated because it pops. It has vision. It has, you know, it has this energy and it goes for it. And you want movies to do that.
Yeah, we definitely want movies to do that. Well, we're going to take a quick break before we're back with the end of the show. We're going to think a little bit more about movies that pop and movies that didn't quite pop for us in 2023. And then we're going to tell you what to expect from us in 2024. Stay tuned. Well, that'll about do it for this edition of the Next Picture Show and for 2023, though in keeping with the usual end of the year movie release schedule, we'll probably still be watching 2023 movies well into the beginning of next year. When is the reveals, like, official top 10 coming out for you guys?
We like to kind of come out with the list a little bit later, just to give ourselves, you know, that period between Christmas and New Year's where things are a little slower. Give us a little more time to catch up on some things. I've got a list of about 10 titles that I'm really wanting to try to catch up with before really final nailing the list down. So like I said, things could shift. But we're going to start the year with it, I think. And then for our subscribers, we'll have another subscriber poll. And we'll do that a month later to give our readers plenty of time to catch things in theaters, just catch things that come out into streaming and digital a little bit later than we have access to it. So that was really, really fun last year. And if you subscribe to The Reveal at thereveal.substack.com, you can participate as well.
Well, those movies that you're hoping to get caught up on, I still have a few myself before I kind of let go of 2023 entirely. A few on my list yet to watch that were big hits over at Polygon, like How to Blow Up a Pipeline and All Dirt Roads Taste of Salt. A few that the critical community, this time of year, I have a tendency to go to screenings and just ask, what's the movie you wish everybody had seen this year? Like that you know is going to be on your top 10 and that not enough people are talking about. And Fallen Leaves and Godland were both on that list movies people have talked about. What do you have left to watch that you're really excited for?
For me, it's the big one. I haven't seen Ferrari, the Michael Mann film. I haven't seen Bo Was Afraid, which I know you're not a fan of, Tasha, but I thought Ari Aster's first two films were incredible. And I missed it in theaters and felt like bereft and just haven't been able to find time where I can really focus it on at home. But I'll do that. And I really want to see the Frederick Wiseman doc, which is like 4 hours long. But is making a lot of lists, and when he's good, and apparently he's really good here, he's really good. And I want two incredibly long French documentaries on my top 10 list. And then I also want to see Perfect Days, the Wim Wenders film, and 1001, which I haven't seen either. So there's a lot.
Keith, what about you?
I'll second 1001. That's a very good film that a lot of people are kind of catching up with. And I, another one I would point people toward that perhaps isn't turning up everywhere is the Eight Mountains, which is a very long and good Italian film about the relationship between two men over the years. But in terms of things I need to catch up with, Perfect Days is a big one for me because I'm very excited to hear that there are people who are loving Wim Wenders. film, a director whose work I like a lot, although I mean those last few narrative films barely got released here, and I should catch up with them someday. But and
this one everyone likes though. Yeah,
yeah. There's a few horror movies I want to catch up with. Innis Main, Skinamarink is a big one I haven't seen yet. I keep hearing good things / crazy things about the Argentinian film When Evil Lurks, which from all reports is not a top 10 consideration necessarily, but you know, it's looks like something I enjoy. Also, A Fire, the Christian Petzold film, he's a director I almost always like. Catch up with that. And also those Corrietas. Corrieta, slow down to keep up with you.
Yeah, When Evil Lurks, not a top tenner for me, but it is currently in my top 20. And maybe that's because I still have a bunch of films left to watch. But it is below movies like Asteroid City from Wes Anderson or Past Lives, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. The top 20 movies this year, really, really diverse in terms of tone and focus and style and just what they're going for. We kind of talked at the beginning of the show about how it was a good year for movies. It was also just a really wild and idiosyncratic year for movies. I think we can all agree that there's just a lot going on in cinema right now for a lot of different audiences, which is pretty exciting.
It is, and it's. I think, as Keith said earlier, it's you don't necessarily feel that until you step back, and then you're like, look at all these titles. Look at what this year has brought us, and it kind of lifts the spirit.
Well, as always, January is going to bring a lot of movies that technically opened in 2023 to the rest of the world. And I imagine that most of the people listening to this podcast are going to be watching some of these movies at the beginning of the year because it's the first chance they're actually going to get to see them in theaters. In some cases, maybe the first chance they're going to get to see them on streaming. In fact, our first pairing of 2024 is going to reflect that with a movie that's technically came out in 2023, but is going wider in 2024. Scott, can you tell us about our next episodes releasing January 9th and 16th?
Sure, Tasha. In Sean Durkin's new movie, The Iron Claw, Fritz von Erich, the patriarch of the von Erich family, is training his sons to succeed him in the professional wrestling business and bring home the world championship belt. But which of his sons is up for the job? And which ones will even survive to keep trying? The tragic bond between a domineering father and his sons in The Iron Claw calls to mind Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather, another epic about brothers vying for succession in an unusual family business. In our first pairing of 2024, we'll compare these toxic dynamics. Surely that's an offer you can't refuse.
For now, we welcome your feedback on our choices for the best movies of 2023 and on anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. Before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Keith, let's just go back to the top of the order and start with you.
All right. I'm a freelance writer. My work appears in places like The Vulture and TV Guide and GQ and The Ringer. But mostly you can find me at The Reveal at thereveal.substack.com, which I co-write with Scott Tobias. Scott Tobias, that's who I co-write it with. Oh. And you can also find me on various socials at KFIPS3000, mostly Blue Sky these days. Scott, how about you?
Yeah, I'm doing a little bit. I've started to tilt a little bit more towards Blue Sky since it's not totally freaking insane and hellish.
There, it pains me to see hard. That you're still on there participating in that garbage.
Wow.
Well, I was going to say for sports.
Blue Sky's bad for sports. I've been you find me on the Reveal, which you should check out for free, you know, and then get a couple of newsletters and see maybe subscribe if you like it. And you can find my work in the New York Times, at Vulture, at Guardian, other fine publications. What about you, Tasha?
I am the film editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Blue Sky at Tasha Robinson. Our absent co-host Genevieve is also on Blue Sky. She is a silent but a powerful presence in our lives, and perhaps if we keep poking her enough, she will eventually say something over there. But meanwhile, she's the TV editor over at Vulture.com. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Blue Sky at The Next Picture Show. Get bonus content and open discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this show. Thanks to Dan the Baked Jakes for his assistance in producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.